The ESC Podcast with John Gailey celebrates its first anniversary with an update on the New Jersey exposure of 3,700 patients to bloodborne pathogens, a look at signage on the outside of your building and in the waiting area, labeling pharmaceuticals, and a discussion of immediate use sterilization.
Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a bi-weekly podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. The ASC regulatory environment is increasingly challenging, but organizations that outsource the regulatory oversight to Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies have an edge. AHS works with ASCs to oversee their quality improvement, risk management, emergency and infection control programs, run their meetings, develop education programs, and always be prepared for surveys. Welcome to episode 45 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for Tuesday, January 15th, 2019, recording from our studios in Rochester, New York. This is Sue Cronkite, Senior Nurse Consultant with AHS. I'm here with John Gailey. John is one of the leading experts in all aspects of the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry, and he is the author of over 10 books about the ASC industry. John is a nationally known speaker and the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. So happy New Year, everybody. I know we're a couple weeks into it, but...
Absolutely. But this is a big milestone for us. This is our first anniversary. Yeah. So 45 episodes and a year into it. We started almost exactly a year ago. Well, a year ago this month. And we're very happy to still be here.
Yep.
And it's amazing the changes that have occurred in this show over the last 12 months. So
kind of been a learning process.
It has been. You know. It's absolutely. It's a huge investment of money and time on our behalf, and we're glad to do it for the industry. And we're very happy when we hear from the people that listen to our podcasts and how much they enjoy listening to us. I don't know if they enjoy listening to us, but perhaps the material that we
they
present.
They put up with us.
They put up with us.
They enjoy the material.
Yeah, we're not exactly experts in public speaking or in...
you kind of are, but...
Yeah, but not so much radio or whatever you call this, podcasting. But we're grateful to be here, and this has been... an interesting couple weeks as we enter the new year. So we opened a brand new center on Friday. You were not with me, Sue, but Alex and I and our new employee went up on Friday, opened up a brand new center, did 12 cases in their first day, which is kind of amazing. And everything went off really without a hitch. And we're very proud of them. They're ready now for their 888C survey, deemed status survey. So now we're just waiting to get that done, and then they'll be fully certified. But we still have four more centers to open during this year. We've got one in Manhattan, one in Garden City, one in Connecticut, and one in Western New York. So it's going to be very busy here. And we do recognize that a lot of our growth has been due to this podcast and our wonderful listeners out there.
So we'll be heading out this week to Austin, Texas. It'll be my first time there. I'm really excited. It's going to be a great conference.
One of my favorite cities. It is. It is the ASCA's 2019 Winter Seminar. We'll be arriving about noontime, about the time it starts on Thursday of this week. And we'll be there right through Saturday. So if you're heading out there, which I highly recommend you do, make sure you meet up with us. Sue and myself will be there, and we'll have Jenna Alvarez, one of our senior nurse consultants, and Lori Rodericks, who is our director of clinical services, will be out there with us. So make sure
hopefully
you stop
doing
by
a podcast too.
Yes,
from there.
I haven't arranged anything,
we're hoping to grab a few people.
There you go. At least we'll pack the equipment. By the way, remind me to pack the equipment before we leave.
Yeah, because we're going to a center first.
Yeah.
And then flying out from there. So we got to think ahead.
That's just not always was remembering.
Easy.
Oh, my. So with that, why don't we jump into the news in the industry? So the biggest news of this week is, of course, Sue?
The ASCA 2019 Winter Seminar.
Absolutely. So it is too late to sign up online, I believe. Yep. But they did send a notice on their website that you can register while you're there. It is a wonderful seminar. I've been doing this for as long as the seminar has been in existence. Mm-hmm. And it's a great opportunity. It's kind of like a mini ASCA conference. Not quite as many people. You get a little bit more personal touch with the speakers there, yeah. A little bit more in-depth perhaps with some of the topics that we get into. There's going to be a really heavy concentration in infection control.
Yeah,
I know you and Jenna are going to be doing that infection control mm-hmm. track.
Yep, and an ASC management essentials. So that's the other track. And coding update and reimbursement strategies. So really, any interest, anything you want to learn, that's
right.
We have a lot of information there. And just meeting up with everybody.
Absolutely. Right.
You know, some networking.
I'll be teaching in the ASC Management Essentials section. I'll be teaching some financial, like an introduction to finances there. And they have asked me to do some interactive stuff. So this is really neat. So I don't think I told you this. But they asked me for 4 questions, which we will poll the audience during the session, and they'll have to answer. And then
answering on their phone. I think I did this at another conference.
I'm not quite sure how that works.
Okay, it'll be sort of a survey thing, not
right.
raising the hand. Okay.
Exactly. So mm-hmm. we get the results back, and then we are able to show the results on the screen. And so I was skeptical at first, I got to admit. Mm-hmm. And then when I started like playing around with it, I kind of had some fun. So we'll see what happens.
Feedback.
So anybody that's looking for some good tips in the ASC management side, or who are new to the ASC management side, definitely that track is good. The coding update and reimbursement strategies, again, ASC Association does this annually. So anybody that's involved in the coding and billing functions will find this particular track very useful. And of course, the infection prevention. So important to note is that you don't have to choose one over the other of these tracks. So if you like a session over in the ASC management track, and then next you want to go over to the infection prevention track, there's no problem moving back and forth. The only reason they ask which one you're going to be in so that we can help kind of balance out the rooms mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. So we have some news this week and some updates, right?
Yep. Well, we were going to mention Farm ASC. Sheldon Soans puts out a newsletter, and he was talking about the importance of recognizing that marijuana is now being legalized in so many areas. So as you're doing your med reconciliation, that it's really important to pay attention to what the updates might be in your state.
And remembering that marijuana is still a Schedule I drug.
Yep. And actually in his newsletter, I was just kind of taking a look at that. There's a lot of great information about the effects that it might have in conjunction with other drugs and the effect of quitting smoking. It seems to be related as well a lot to like cigarette smoking, where you know that the circulation and the risk of that the circulation would improve and the risk of infection can go down if you stop. And he's got a timeline of anywhere from 12 hours before surgery to 8 weeks before surgery that you could kind of go over with your patients if you're concerned about it and see what you might encourage them to do.
So I think the takeaways from that particular article, and again, we encourage you to contact Sheldon Soans about this or mm-hmm. Subscribe to his newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
The takeaways that I got from reading it are the encourage your patients to quit smoking marijuana as far in advance of the surgery as possible mm-hmm, to mm-hmm. improve their outcome or to lessen the chance of complications.
Yep. Now, he did make a point. If it is a medical marijuana and it's, prescribed, that's a different case, and you have to kind of be aware of that.
Right. And of course, the other big part is making sure that we encourage our patients to provide mm-hmm. information so that we can give them good, them good care.
Legal or not, we have to make sure that we're reconciling the medications.
Correct. So, Sue, I know we also have an update on the New Jersey Surgery Center that had mm-hmm. some infection control issues.
So, as of right now, they're saying that only about a third of the patients have been successfully notified, the patients that could be at risk, and 10% of the affected patients have received their test results. So, it's still quite an ongoing process.
And I also understand that the first lawsuits have already been filed about this mm-hmm. particular case. So, again, the importance of making sure you don't even get into this situation in the first place. And remember, as we've been reminding our clients, there have been no infections reported as of now. I believe that they might.
I think the one was an infection, but they don't know that it's related to this.
Right. So this came about as a result of observing poor infection practices, mm-hmm, not mm-hmm. as a result of them observing a lot of infections in the center. So that's an important thing to note, is that mm-hmm. we can go around saying, hey, I don't have any infections, therefore I'm doing a good job.
Yeah.
If they find that you're not doing good practices, mm-hmm. you're going to get into trouble. Mm-hmm. So the state health department did issue some information about what they found in the center. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So they found they had a very outdated infection control plan. So again, it's always important to keep up with any changes, unacceptable sterilization practices. And again, not always following the manufacturer's sterilization and cleaning instructions. They just weren't updating those.
And keeping those current mm-hmm. and available in an area that people can readily access it and
yep, reference it. Yeah, that's important. Because, I mean, sometimes you think people know what they're doing, but, you know, if you keep everything right together, people can always check and look. And even just doing in services or, you know, annual training and right. making sure everybody's always up to date on that. The operating rooms were not being properly cleaned and disinfected between procedures. That was made public on Friday. In one instance, and this is horrible, an inspector saw a stretcher in a hallway with a bloodstained sheet that wasn't properly disinfected, even after he pointed it out to the staffer. So the state surveyors also found that the facility improperly stored sterilized items, which jeopardized their cleanliness, while other sterilized instruments revealed rust-like stains. So they were closed, I think, for 3 weeks.
Correct.
A couple people fired. The
right. Senior management, I believe the nurse manager left. Yep. Yeah.
And they did open back up, and as part of their plan of corrections, they have agreed to do quarterly infection control audits and sterilization audits every 6 months.
Now, I don't quite understand what that means, of course, because yeah. we don't have access to the mm-hmm, actual mm-hmm. Plan of correction, but certainly we expect that on a quarterly basis, there's going to be a report to the Quality Improvement Committee yeah. about what's going on in your infection control mm-hmm. plan. You should be doing quarterly surveillance of hand hygiene, sharp safety, and environmental factors. You should be checking on a quarterly basis for infections. You should be, you know, surveilling. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about this in a little bit. Yep. Actually surveilling your doctors for any infections that might have been found. And then really reporting on any sterilization issues mm-hmm. in the sterilizers, like how are they performing? Have you had any issues with regard to instruments that haven't been properly cleaned, et cetera? So all those things. Whereas this was a plan of correction, I think yeah. every center should be doing the items that they're referring to mm-hmm, there. So. Mm-hmm.
So we thought we'd talk a little bit about infections. So as I was looking into some other larger scale infections, just to see what had been out there, I did see some instances a few years back of bacterial meningitis being caused by their provider not wearing a face mask while administering spinal injections.
Wow,
so
that's
that was just a...
Yeah, that's a very controversial subject. Mm-hmm. I know in some centers, we do insist among our clients that anybody that does spinal injections be wearing a face mask. But I know that, that there's quite a bit of pushback in some areas mm-hmm. For that. So it's
yeah, that's interesting. So important. And because these risks vary so much by center, obviously this would be, you know, a pain center or something doing the spinal injections. We want to talk a little bit about the infection control risk assessment tool, which is the tool that you can use to right. pinpoint where you should focus your infection prevention.
So this is a rule that's been around for a while, but now surveyors are really enforcing it. So make sure that on an annual basis, you you update your infection control risk assessment, mm-hmm. to identify the types of risks and infections that you potentially have in your organization and what you're going to do to mitigate that, what you're going to do to surveil, monitor, and what types of training you're going to do, as well as any drills that you might perform mm-hmm. in order to assure that you're always prepared.
Yeah, and I think one of the stumbling blocks that a lot of people run into with this is they don't want to get a higher score. They want to yeah. say, oh, this isn't much of a risk because we've taken care of it. But it's important to say what the risk could be and then how you're mitigating it.
Right.
And there are going to be some higher numbers. There have right. to be, so that you know what to focus on.
And that's a very good point, Sue. That's what I found, too, is that they play with the formulas in the infection control risk mm-hmm. assessment to get the number down to zero. And really, that's not what we want to do. We want to make sure that we justify why we have an active infection mm-hmm. control program and why we continue to do the surveillance. And of course, you know, being able to justify that we've gotten all these processes in place, even if we do have an infection, that we took whatever measures we could in order to prevent infections. Harder to prove that when you don't do an infection control.
Yeah, and focusing all of your majority of your efforts on the things that not only are more likely to happen, but the things that'll cause real harm if they do.
Right.
So another just a small reminder, transporting your instruments to the sterilizer.
Even if they're just next door, they need to be transported in a rigid container with a solid bottom, puncture proof, and the container needs to have a biohazard label on it indicating what's in there. We're running into this. I ran into a center that was transporting the scopes from the GI room to the cleaning room, to the endoscope reprocessing area, and they showed me how it was done in a bag, basically. And I said, "That's not acceptable anymore." And they said, "Why?" And I pointed to the floor where there were fluids that had drained out of the bag. And I said, "That's why it needs to be in a rigid container."
Or if you fell and you, just scary to think of. But yeah, and having that sticker on there.
And again, I need to emphasize, it doesn't matter how close that room is. Mm-hmm. If it's right next door, you still have to have it in a rigid container.
Okay. And another thing, and this is something that I've noticed when I worked in the hospital as well as in some surgery centers, the privacy curtains and bed sheets they mention here, but especially the privacy curtains, I'm not sure how often they get.
Well, first of all, let me talk about privacy curtains because Alex and two of our employees and myself have personal experience with putting privacy curtains up. So on Friday, when we started this new center, the woman came in at, I think we got there about 7 o'clock, and she says, I wasn't able to get the privacy curtains up. So every one of us that had gotten there early spent the next hour hanging those privacy curtains. So your point is well taken. I got to be kind of intimately, familiar with what these privacy curtains are.
And I'm laughing at myself because now that you're saying this,
yeah,
when you had told me that, I could picture you and Alex putting up like window curtain. I don't know. I couldn't figure out why. I thought, well, it's a new center. They're helping decorate. And it just never dawned on me.
We're actually doing real work.
This makes so much more sense now. Okay.
Yeah. But the point is those are, that is fabric, washable fabric at that, but it is fabric and touching it with your dirty hands is going to
infect it. And it's constantly in and out. And people don't always think, because they're not touching the patient. They're just pushing the curtain aside. But it just builds up on there. Right. So there was an article in the December 3rd issue of Infection Control Today by Kelly Pyrek, and it addressed the potential for contamination due to these soft surfaces. The article noted that 56% of respondents used curtains in the ambulatory care center. Approximately 45% clean or change the curtains in the ambulatory care center only when they're visibly soiled. This was similar to hospitals, so I'm not...
Right.
The suggestions are to be sure to have a policy on the cleaning and changing of your privacy curtains, and they could be different for every center.
Right.
And, how busy you are, what types of patients you have.
How much bodily fluid you're in contact with, the types of bodily fluid you're in contact with, how messy the procedures are that you're doing.
The hand hygiene, I think, is important in this as well. Not only cleaning your hands before you go to touch the curtain so that you won't be getting things on there. Some people will do only that. They kind of push the curtain aside and then go into the patient. Well, I just washed my hands. But, make sure you're doing it right at the bedside. And I know that may be obvious, but it's something to think about. So now just a note about medications. I noticed the FDA had a warning on their site a couple months back about some medication errors that have been caused by labeling inconsistencies due to the shortages, some of the inconsistencies with compounding pharmacies versus conventional pharmacies. So the FDA recommends for small volume parenteral products, the strength per total volume should be the primary and prominent expression on the principal display panel of the label, followed in close proximity by strength per milliliter enclosed by parentheses. So basically, we get used to seeing the strength of the medication set up in a certain way, and some of the compounding pharmacies are not doing it that same way. So there have been some errors with people misunderstanding the concentration versus the total volume. So it's just really important to make sure that things are being labeled correctly. And if they're not, make a big deal out of, pointing that out to people in the center.
And that just follows up on our ongoing concerns about what's happening with drugs and the shortages that we have. Yep. So we're going to take a break here and we're going to come back with just kind of like a hodgepodge of various items that have come up over the last couple of weeks that we thought we'd talk about.
Okay.
So we'll be right back. So, Sue, for our second segment today, I thought we would just go over various questions that have been asked over the last couple months from our clients, some of the issues that we found as we've been working with the clients, General questions that I've seen even on some websites. I've responded to a couple recently on LinkedIn, for example. So just a number of very interesting things. We'll start by talking about infection follow-up. So one, a question on LinkedIn this last week was how frequently or what should be the time frame for following up on infections on an implant. And the answer to that is both at 30 days and at 90 days. So you should always be following up about 30 days afterwards to see if there's any infections. Not too soon. You know, in other words, you don't you don't ask the doctor the day after whether an infection occurred, because it's, obviously it's going to take some time to manifest itself. So we usually wait for about a month afterwards before we send that initial infection surveillance form out.
Okay, so are you contacting the patient, sending out some information?
Yeah, no, so that's a good point that we probably should remind people, is that you have to have a robust program for identifying infections in your organization. The first thing you should do is tell your patient, hey, tell me when you had an infection, and make sure you talk to your doctor about it. Yeah. And second, you need to talk to your doctors and tell them that you're going to be sending out a regular list. Usually what you do is you send a list of all the procedures that they did the previous month and ask them if there have been any complications, including infections, and ask them to sign off on that form indicating either that there were no infections or complications, or that there were, and these are the results. And, and then the person following up on this needs to make sure that they follow up on and close all the loops on any of those issues that are identified. This is tough to get physicians to provide the information. I will say, as that we've talked about this in previous podcasts, that we're concerned, especially in the GI area, that we might be missing infections simply because the doctors don't really, you know, take it too seriously, or don't follow up on it, or maybe they don't even know.
Yeah, if the patients aren't educated well enough to know, they just go to their primary care doctor or go to the hospital and never think of getting back and contacting
with the surgery center so that we can close that feedback loop. So let's just remind everyone that it is important to send out a list. Most of your software developed for the surgery center industry will print a list for you to send to your doctors, asking them to verify what the results of their cases were, whether there are any complications or any infections that manifested themselves afterwards. And that should be sent 30 days after the end of the month. And again, for implants, if anybody had an implant, you should be following up again at 90 days, again, with the surgeon to determine if there have been any issues. Now, an ideal thing to do would be to talk to the patient 30 days afterwards or 90 days afterwards. I don't think that that's reasonable in most surgery centers. It would be quite a burden, and I haven't seen that asked. But if you really are serious about it, or if you have, you know, if you know that you've got an infection problem, you probably should be doing this more frequently and following up more frequently.
Now, do you usually track this in total, or do you track it by doctor?
Both. We do it both ways, right? Interesting point, though, is I've run into places where when I ask them about their infection control plan, this is during surveys, people will bring out these big binders with these long lists of all the cases done, with the doctor signing off saying there were no infections, and they say, this is my infection control plan. No, this only tells me that you didn't have any infection. It doesn't tell me anything about the surveillance mechanisms that you have, your protocols, and you know, your sterilization processes, et cetera. So it's important that you understand that this is actually a relatively small part of the infection, an important part, but a small part of the overall infection control plan to make sure that you do monitor and find a good way to get feedback about infections. Second area is medication labeling. I think people are probably getting tired of me talking about this, but it still happened. This last week, I had a doctor who, again, I noted had not been labeling the syringes properly, and indicated that it needs to be labeled with the drug name, the drug strength, the expiration date and time. Now, so if you've pulled the drug into a syringe, it's in a different container. So it has to have the drug name, the strength, the expiration date and time, which is usually within 1 hour unless the manufacturer tells you otherwise, and the name or the initials of the individuals that transfer the drugs into that syringe.
And the only time not is if it's not leaving your hand, correct?
That is correct. Actually, thank you.
And you are right then.
Right, administering it immediately. So this is extremely important to remember. Surveyors will cite this. So I made this point to a physician. He came back and says, well, the labels are not sterile. Now, I'm not the expert on labels, so I immediately called Jenna, our senior nurse consultant, you weren't available, Sue. And she got back to me right away and said, John, there are sterile labels. And that you should be using them for anything in the sterile field. So, and I think the important thing we have to remember is there have been very serious negative ramifications mm-hmm. of not labeling the drugs or not looking at the label on the drugs properly. So I think, we could tell horror stories. We have told some horror stories, but reemphasizing this to your doctors constantly and help them to understand why the surveyors think this is something very important. Mm-hmm. There was also some ARN information that we obtained about how medications in the sterile field should be labeled, and the label for the medication container on the sterile field should include the medication name, strength, dilution, and the dilutant if used, the date and time accepted to the sterile field, the approved, can use approved abbreviations and dose expressions, and really recommend Tallman lettering when look like and sound alike names are present. So then immediate use during sterilization came back. In other words, the old term flash sterilization came up this last week. We were talking to a center that used IUSS. Most of our centers, you know, do very little, if any, IUSS at all. IUSS standing for immediate use steam sterilization, the old term for flash sterilization. So it is acceptable to use immediate use steam sterilization if something happened in the operating room that you absolutely have to re-sterilize an instrument. You drop something, an instrument breaks, and you don't have a replacement. Whatever, you know, I mean, it's far preferable to
canceling the surgery or stopping.
You you want to be able to get that that instrument back in the field as soon as possible. What's not acceptable is, and it's not a good reason, is, oh, I ran out of instruments because I didn't sterilize enough last night, or I don't own enough instruments to be able to sterilize these instruments quickly enough to be able to turn over.
Should be very limited.
That's right. And, of course, this has been a problem in the ophthalmology field for many years, and it really, there's been quite a bit of a crackdown on this area. So you should be maintaining an IUSS log, reporting that log on a quarterly basis to the Infection Control Committee and or the Quality Improvement Committee, identifying whether the IUSS cases or the situations that occurred were appropriate. And, you know, if you did have a couple situations where you had to do it because you ran out of instruments, then this is a good time to notify the governing body that maybe it's time to buy some more instrumentation. Another area I ran into is signage in the waiting area and outside the building. So I think everybody understands how important this is, but
I think they get pulled down so often with cleaning, or they just, because they seem like they'll be there and then they're not there the next time.
That's clearly what's happened in a couple of our centers here. I don't know how they keep disappearing, because I don't think the signs are that pretty that people would want to take them off the wall and take them home.
They're probably not posting.
So let's start outside the building. What should be on the outside of the building? You should obviously have a no smoking sign indicating that the building is a non-smoking campus. If you don't have the sign outside the building, you basically have to have no smoking signs throughout the center. So be very careful about that. It's far better to just make the entire building no smoking than to try to figure out what parts of the building would be no smoking.
Yeah. And you should post your hours of operation, especially if you're in a shared space. Make sure that your hours are posted there.
Right. So what we mean about that shared space is sometimes the surgery center might share the space with an office-based laboratory, office-based surgery center, or a practice. And you need to carefully delineate what part of the day is it's a surgery center versus what any other use of it. So, and also to provide information to patients as to when to show up for services.
Yeah. And what to do in an emergency. You should have this obviously recorded on your phone, but also if somebody just shows up at your center, note that the facility does not provide emergency services. Note to call the doctor, call 911, go to the nearest emergency room.
In that order. So, encourage them to call their doctor first if there's any complications. But if they did show up after hours, most likely they probably are in dire straits and need to either go to call 911 or go to the nearest emergency room. And then inside the waiting area, what are we looking for?
The patient rights and responsibilities. In New York, there are two patient rights posters that are required. So remember that.
Yeah. So we have about 25% of our audience, I think, at this point is from New York. So maybe we should mention, again, New York recently notified centers that there has to be a specific poster for New York Ambulatory Surgery Centers, and as well as any diagnostic and treatment center, which ASC is a part of in New York. And because that poster doesn't include all the things that are required for CMS and for the accreditation standards, you'll need a second patient rights and responsibility poster also.
And the patient privacy notice.
Which doesn't always actually have to be posted, Sue. So this can be, like in the center that we open on Friday, they have this wonderful binder that is in very prominently displayed in the waiting area. And it's referenced in the documentation that they provide the patients up front.
Okay.
So they'll say, hey, there's a patient privacy notice available to you right back there. I have a copy over here if you want it. It itself does not really have to be posted.
Okay. The ownership of the center, and that may be also something you can just have available and offer.
Correct. Many doctors don't really want to have their names like posted prominently in the waiting area, and that is acceptable as long as you have it available to anybody that asks for it. Now, by the way, that could differ by state. There are some states, I believe, that do require the ownership to be posted prominently.
Okay. Your state license and your pharmacy license.
If your state does require a state license, I should point out.
Okay. And the pharmacy license?
Yeah, that's an interesting issue. Most states actually do not require the center, or do not allow the center to get their own individual pharmacy license. So the license of the practitioner who purchases the drugs on behalf of the organization would be what has to be posted. Now, this is a bit controversial because there's a lot of private information on that. License. So this is one of those areas that we encourage you to post it publicly, but don't put it in an area that's super easy to find, which I believe meet the requirements.
Okay. You want to post who to contact with a complaint.
And this would be the state, the Medicare ombudsman, the accreditation organization, as well as the person in the organization who you send complaints to.
Okay. So yeah, it can't just be one thing. They have to really give you that whole hierarchy.
Right.
The anti-discrimination.
So these are the new 2016 rules that required you to basically do three things. So you need to post a non-discrimination notice in a conspicuous area. And the notices need to be in English and other languages that can be available. So you don't have to post it in every language, unless, of course, you're in an area where the only language is not English. But you can have the sign posted in English and then other languages be
available upon request.
Correct.
Right.
And then the tagline poster. The tagline poster is, so this requires ASCs to post taglines that tell non-English speaking individuals that language assistance services are available. And these taglines must be in the top 15 languages spoken in the state in which the ASC is located. And the posting of the tagline should be in a conspicuous location, such as the check-in or waiting area of the practice.
Yep. So you really have to know what it is in your state.
Right. And it doesn't vary throughout the state. So as long as you get the information in the state. So and the way these taglines look is you have these, you know, languages listed. The patient would basically point to one. The receptionist would look and say, okay, that is Swahili. And then they know to contact the language
line. An interpreter or the language.
Correct. Line. Correct. Yeah. And then the last thing is a statement. So again, we're talking about the 2016 anti-discrimination. And this doesn't have to do with signage, but there needs to be a statement of non-discrimination included in all significant publications or communications in the organization. Well, that was a bit of a whirlwind, wasn't it? We're well over our 30 minutes here already. So let's take a break. We'll come back and talk a little bit about upcoming events.
John, you've written a number of popular books about the ASC industry. Can you tell us about them?
Sure. So the two that are in publication right now, which are most popular, is the ASC Survey Guide, which is a guide to the Ambulatory Surgery Center Conditions for Coverage and Interpretive Guidelines. And it basically, it's very, very long, but it's a nicely indexed book that provides all the regulations applicable for Medicare-certified surgery centers in the United States with the interpretive guidelines nicely referenced so that you can find the interpretive guidelines that apply to the specific regulations, as well as any of the additional information that's provided by CMS for each of those regulations. And the second book is the ASC governance book, which is a great book for either a governing body members or owners of surgery centers or the administrators who like to know what the surgery center owners need to be doing. It's nice and short because it's written largely for doctors who have short attention spans. Just kidding. But anyway, it's a good book to understand what responsibility you take on when you join the governing body of an organization. So,
okay. And how does someone get these books?
So please visit reg-books.com. That's regbooks.com, regbooks.com. And you can purchase both of those books at that website. You can also get a special offer if you purchase a book through the website for a one-day consultation with me for $19.95, which includes a tour of your facility, review of your quality assurance program, governing body meetings, look at the sample of medical records, credential charts and employee charts, scan of the policy manual, you know, kind of review, quick overview of the life safety stuff. And it includes a very comprehensive debriefing afterwards, a full day on site with you. I love doing these things. It's great to get out and talk to people. Most of the time, you know, people are really grateful. Actually, all the time, people are very grateful for this service. And at $19.95, you can't get a better deal. You can also buy the books on Amazon or most online book websites.
Every episode, we will inform you of upcoming events. If you would like your event to be included in the podcast, please send the event information to info@ascpodcast.com.
So, as we've talked about, the 2019 Ask a Winter seminars are January 17th through the 19th in Austin, Texas. We're heading down there on Wednesday morning. It's going to be at the Hilton Austin. And there's going to be three tracks, ASC Management Essentials, Coding Update and Reimbursement Strategies, and Infection Prevention Techniques in ASCs. It's too late to sign up online, but you can definitely show up there and sign up on site.
Yep. And the next Certified Ambulatory Infection Preventionist, or CAPE exam, is scheduled for March 1st through 31st, 2019, at testing sites throughout the United States. Electronic application must be submitted January 1st through 31st, 2019. For more information, please visit aboutcaip.org, aboutcaip.org.
The next Certified Ambulatory Surgery Center Administrator, or CASC exam, is scheduled for May 1st through the 31st, 2019, at testing sites throughout the United States. Electronic application must be submitted between March 1st and 31st, 2019. For more information, please visit aboutcasc.org, aboutcasc.org.
ASCA 2019 will be at the Gaylord Opryland Resort and Convention Center in Nashville, Tennessee, May 15th through the 18th, 2019.
And this is going to be the best ASCA ever, I think. I'm very excited. I'm on the education committee. We'll be there in force with virtually everybody. We'll have to leave somebody at home. we'll definitely have a heavy presence there.
The Association for Professionals in Infection Control and Epidemiology Incorporated, or APICS, 46th Annual Conference is June 12th through 14th, 2019 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
The Arizona Ambulatory Surgery Center Association, AASCA Annual Conference is June 27th through the 28th, 2019 at the Camelback Inn and Spa in Scottsdale, Arizona. And I know the New York State Association will be having its next meeting in June. We can't announce the date yet, but we'll get that to you as soon as we can. That's it for this edition of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey. Join us again. And please spread the word about our podcast with your friends and colleagues and do us the honor of hitting the subscribe button.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, All Rights Reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors. First, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For a free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. And Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including the Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you're interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.